This is the first in a series that I'll be doing this week entitled U.S. Foreign Policy at the Crossroads. And maybe the title for that will become more evident as we go along. And this first session is entitled The Middle East, Who's Holy Land? And I'll say more about that title in a moment. My name is Joel Muggy, and I'm the director of the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And I think it's important I say a word or two about the center, because what I'm presenting this week is very connected with the work of the center and what we do there. So the center has, I would say, two primary goals in its work. One is what has become known, at least in Lutheran circles, as the internationalization of mission. That is, to begin to see that perhaps the North American church doesn't have necessarily the gift of the gospel to give everyone else, but that maybe some other churches have some gifts of the gospel to share with us. That is to say that Christians in other parts of the world may have a mission to us in North America in terms of their understanding of the faith and of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The second goal, I think, one could say about our work is somehow the democratization of U.S. foreign policy. And that is to say that we don't really accept what many U.S. officials would like to say, and that is that it's the business of the State Department and the President alone to make foreign policy. That is, that U.S. citizens are notoriously uninformed about foreign policy issues and ought to have a role in determining the shape of the policy of the country of the country in which they live. And so our means of accomplishing those goals at the center, one of those means is to coordinate travel seminars to many parts of the world. We have emphasized, or much of our work has been in Central America, but in recent years we have also had travel seminars in the Philippines, in the Caribbean, and in the Middle East. And these are not vacations, as people who have been on them will tell you. They're very intensive look at many of the issues that are at work in the countries that are being visited. I forgot today to bring the material about the center. I'll bring it in future sessions that you can pick up things if you'd like. In this series, I'm going to use as case studies three areas of conflict in the world where the role of U.S. foreign policy is critical in determining the shape of events: the Middle East, the Philippines, and Central America. And all of these are areas in which we have conducted travel seminars, and I've had the opportunity to travel several times. In each session, we'll examine a bit of the historical context of the current crisis, first of all, then a little bit of the current situation as it's being played out, and finally the role of U.S. foreign policy in that particular region. And then at the final session on Saturday, we'll examine one of the ideologies that has come to undergird our foreign policy, that is the ideology of national security, and also a key strategy that has become important for U.S. foreign policy, and that's the strategy of low-intensity conflict. We'll talk about those more on Saturday, but I'll be alluding to them during the week. Also, a couple of preliminary comments. This series is going to be a very broad stroke overview. I mean, it's almost ridiculous to be doing what we're trying to do in these four sessions, talk about three areas of the world and then sum it up. I mean, that's in terms of U.S. foreign policy. And that's going to be a problem when we're trying to understand such complex issues. Nevertheless, what we'll try to do is identify the basic trends and themes in each of the regions, and then try to identify what might be some of the common problems with U.S. foreign policy. And I think it'll become very clear to you very quickly. I have some problems with our foreign policy in general. And then what might be some alternatives to our policy? Okay, any questions about sort of that scenario that we hope to proceed with this week? Yes?
Are you going to be also discussing what we can do to possibly make impact on the
policy? Yes, we certainly will. We'll try to do that a little bit in each area, but especially on Saturday we'll spend some time with that. Yes?
So the basic format of lecture is going to be...
No, we'd really like you to dialogue, and I'd like... I've got a lot of material, and so I'm going to try to stop and let you interact, and I want to try to leave questions at the end. But please, and this, I know this often doesn't work, please feel free to interrupt and ask questions. I'll try to stop and let you let some interchange happen, but you force me to it as well. Okay, let's proceed then. Our first session is on the Middle East, and I've laid out just some dates that I'm going to be referring to, as well as a kind of map of the region. Somebody asked me earlier, could you tell us a little bit of the scale of this map? And I don't have the scale down. I know that, for example, from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, it's about an hour's drive. From Jerusalem down to the bridge to Jordan, it's about 45 minutes. This is a very, very small country. The Middle East, of course, is the site of many conflicts at the present time. The Iran-Iraq War, Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. There are many issues at work in the Middle East, and we can't begin to deal with them all. And what I want to focus on today is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we're going to isolate that particular aspect of the crisis and deal with that. Now, why should we be concerned about the Middle East, first of all? I would say that there are at least three reasons. First of all, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict threatens not only parties involved in this region, but potentially the whole world as well. It's often talked about as one of the places where a nuclear confrontation could begin, especially now that Israel has nuclear capability and the kind of arms escalation that has happened in the region. It's very possible that something could happen there. Secondly, the Middle East has had more than its share of conflict in the last 65 years or so. Tens of thousands have been killed, displaced, and disabled in that region. And finally, I think, as Christians who believe that Christ came to reconcile humankind to God and to each other, we owe it to our Jewish, our Christian, and our Muslim brothers and sisters to understand who they are and why they believe and act the way they do. I think the city of Jerusalem itself is one symbol of the roots of the crisis. Here is a holy city for three monotheistic faiths. The title of the presentation, Whose Holy Land, is really a variation on the title of a book that I'd recommend to you, Whose Promised Land, by Colin Chapman. And it's really asking the question, whose land is this? And that you'll find is the central issue of what we're dealing with here. In Jerusalem, you find the Dome of the Rock, the second most important site of Islam, where Muhammad was to have ascended into heaven. You find, of course, the Dome of the Rock is situated on the site of the temple that was destroyed and where the new temple is to be built. So for the Jewish community is the most important site in their faith. And of course, Jerusalem is the site of the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the most important city for the Christian faith. And then that becomes complicated by the fact that you have both within the Arab community, both Muslims and Christians. And in fact, it's often a surprise to many groups to discover that one of our sister churches, the Lutheran Church, is the Lutheran Church of Jordan, which is basically a Palestinian church. The Bishop of Jordan, of the Jordanian Church, is located in Jerusalem because, as we keep in mind, the West Bank is still part of Jordan. We'll get to that. But that there's a very strong community of Palestinian Lutherans who are part of the community of faith that we share together. The Episcopal Church is very strong, and many of the Orthodox branches of the Orthodox faith also very strong within the Palestinian community. Now, while there are ample religious roots to the crisis in the Middle East, our focus is going to be a little bit more on the historical and political roots of that crisis. In many respects, I think it can be said that both sides of the conflict, and when I'm talking about both sides, we're going to be talking about the Israelis and the Palestinians here, are prisoners of their own very tragic past. And I'll try not to spend a lot of time on history, but some of it merits discussion. North Americans are often sort of allergic to history. We like to get to right to what's happening. But I think it's important we focus a little bit on history to understand what has brought these two peoples to such a tragic kind of confrontation. In 135 AD, the Roman Emperor Hadrian put down the revolt led by Simon Bar Kochba, and Jerusalem and the temple were totally destroyed. The Jews could not teach or practice their religion. The conflict, they couldn't enter the city of Jerusalem after that. And Jews in other parts of Palestine faced death and deportation and slavery. A forced migration began, which was really a continuation of the dispersion that originally took place in 586 BC when the Babylonians conquered the southern kingdom and deported thousands of Jews into exile and slavery in Babylon. Following centuries of Jewish life in the diaspora, in the dispersion, that is, there were those centuries were a period of intermittent acceptance, annihilation, rejection, and finally genocide as they scattered really to all parts of Europe, to the Soviet Union and to Africa. In that process then emerged the anti-Semitism that we know today. And anti-Semitism, as it emerged, was a particularly Christian invention. The Jews killed Christ. And that view is a view that has only been rescinded by the church officially in the last 50 years. So that idea of the Jews as the ones who murdered Christ has been one of the very strong roots of anti-Semitism. Furthermore, Jewish intellectuals were hated for their liberal ideas. Often in many of the places where they settled, they stressed individual rights and socialist values, and there was a tendency to lump them all together and judge all Jews guilty of that kind of liberal ideology. They were often viewed as a mongrel race and as perpetual aliens, people who exploited misfortunes of the legitimate national population of wherever they lived. In other words, they were sort of the outcasts, but they exploited the people who really belonged there, and so they became an easy target to blame for every problem. Now, it's out of that experience, out of that Jewish experience in the diaspora, that Zionism emerged. Zionism, as a political ideology, arose from the very specific anti-Semitic situation that existed in Russia before and after the turn of the century. Jews were, again, viewed as carriers of liberal ideas which threatened to undermine the powers of the powers that be, in that case, the powers of the church and the state. The powers responded with a term that became common then in the Jewish vocabulary, pogroms, spontaneous uprisings against the Jewish community involving looting, rape, and murder, intended to attack the Jewish community. And in many cases, as Jews found out, the police stood by and responded only when the worst had been done. So between 1871 and 1910, over a million Jews left Russia to the United States and some parts of Europe, and a few then began to go into Palestine. Now, some did not want to settle in another alien country. They just didn't want to do that again. They wanted their own nation that could be, where they could be responsible for their own lives and for their own safety. For 18 centuries, they had been praying every Passover that they might celebrate the next year in Jerusalem. And so what other place to go than to Jerusalem? Thus it was that Zionism was born as a Jewish political liberation movement with the goal to establish a new nation again in historic Palestine. In 1896, Theodor Herzl, who is generally considered to be the father of modern Israel, started looking for land because it wasn't always assumed that Palestine would be the only place that they would go. Herzl really had the idea that perhaps there could be found a place where they wouldn't displace the population that was already there. And places in South America were considered, Uganda was considered, and Palestine as well. But the Jewish settlement was so strong to choose Palestine that that's eventually the place that was chosen. Now, contrary to what Jews have been told about uninhabited Palestine, the Jews, as they began to return, discovered a land inhabited by many people, including 500,000 Arabs, and only 66,000 Jews. And that was really after two waves of immigration had already begun.
You say these people chose this. How did they go about it? What was the process of choice?
Well, there was a meeting that took place in Switzerland among some members of the Jewish community. And I don't know the details of how it was specifically decided on Palestine, but it was part of that, much of the history of the Jewish people almost demanded that Palestine be the place to which they return. And that there was just a constant process that led to that choice. There were other choices that were made along the way that we'll talk about that really officialized that we'll talk about in a moment.
Wasn't it scripturally also?
Right, certainly. That's you know, it was the promised land for the Jewish people. That for them was their home. So what they discovered were 5,000 Arabs living in Palestine, and the Arabs also called this home. The Arabs have been living under Turkish rule since 1516, and many were longing for a national identity of their own. During the First World War, Europeans and the British especially, supported this idea and specifically encouraged the Arabs to revolt against the Turks to keep Turkish forces occupied and out of the way, out of Europe, so the Turks would stay out of Europe, and also keep them away from Egypt and Suez. Now, the Arabs hoped that if they were successful then in their independence or getting independence from the Turks, that European powers would support their promise, which they promised to the Arabs, the birth of an independent nation in Syria, Iraq, which is over here, Jordan, Israel, and parts of Saudi Arabia down here. That was their hope. But the promises were not kept. After the First World War, the British took control of Palestine and also Iraq, and the French controlled Syria. Even worse, yes?
Palestine being what is now primarily Israel and Jordan.
Right. When we're referring to Palestine, we're referring primarily to Israel and the West Bank, okay? And I think parts of Jordan, but primarily this area here, that's the West, Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip.
What is now known as Israel.
What is now known as Israel by some Israelis, all right? And in fact, these areas are referred to as the occupied territory.
The West Bank then is all that big area that you have.
This is the West Bank, this is the Gaza Strip, okay. And this is the Golan Heights. Okay? Even worse, the British passed in 1917 something called the Balfour Declaration, which granted the Zionists the right to establish a national home in Palestine. Now, one writer described that, the Balfour Declaration, as, and I quote, "a document in which one nation solemnly promises to a second nation the country of a third nation."
No.
And yes.
Wasn't there also words in the Balfour Declaration, as long as they did not disrupt the existing citizens or something like
right.
that?
Right.
So they promised the same land to two people?
That's essentially right. That's essentially correct.
So long as the two people didn't bother each other.
That's right. And in fact, the next few years were a gradual separation into really two separate economies of the two people. There was some protest, obviously, by the Arabs. But it didn't become physically violent until about 1920, when the Arabs attacked the Jewish quarter in Old Jerusalem. Now, as immigration grew, more and more Arab tenant farmers were pushed off their land during these next decades. And Arab absentee landlords, many Arab landlords were outside of the country, and they would sell their property for two or three times its value, and then the tenant farmers on their land were the ones who were stuck. And so they were forced to work in the cities for long hours at low wages. In the 20s and 30s, the Arabs protested the large number of Jewish immigrants as they began to see the seeds of a Jewish state being happening, rather than just a home, so to speak. And as Oriental people with an Oriental culture, the Arabs were forced to confront this largely European culture, which was technically advanced and skilled in dealing within a Western political structure. And so what happened is that they were being forced to play a Western political game. They didn't know the rules many times, and then they refused to accept the rules, and both of those things helped the Zionists to achieve their goals, often by default. For example, the British suggested in 1921 a legislative assembly for the Arab community. The Arabs had no experience with representative institutions, so they rejected the plan. And when faced with imported strategies or thought patterns that they weren't accustomed to, they often retreated to very uncompromising positions, and saying, absolutely not. So many things were lost in that process for them. During the late 30s, after Hitler's Nuremberg laws, which began to really reduce the Jewish population to less than humans in their application, Jewish immigration to Palestine grew dramatically, obviously. This increase in immigration led Britain, after the war, to attempt to limit immigration. This was met with resistance from Jewish terrorist organizations at that time. The British submitted this problem to the UN, which proposed a partition plan that is somewhat similar to what now are the occupied territories in terms of the partition that was to be divided, how Israel was to be divided. The conflict escalated, and the British announced that they would finally withdraw. They simply couldn't stay because of the constant attack on the part of many Jewish organizations. And so in May of 1948, the British withdrew, and the very same day, the Zionists proclaimed the establishment of the State of Israel. Now, 1 month before, yes?
During that period of 1920, or the Balfour, mm-hmm. until 48, what form of government did the Arabs really have?
This was really a British territory still, right. So it was governed by the British. And there really was no Arab government, so to speak. It was the British.
So there was no community councils or anything.
No. It was a British held mandate at that time.
And no official Jewish government either.
No, that's correct. But there was this. But what emerged are these separate communities and separate economies that started forming during that time. Now, 1 month before the British withdrew, a very important event in history took place, and that was the Jewish terrorist group Irgun carried out a massacre of about 250 people in a suburb of Jerusalem called Deir Yassin. The head of Irgun, this was a massacre against Palestinians, mostly women and children, because it happened during the day when the husbands were out working. The head of the Irgun was Menachem Begin. All of you remember Menachem Begin, former prime minister? And the other group that claimed responsibility for the massacre was the Stern Gang. And one of the leaders of the Stern Gang was none other than Yitzhak Shamir, the current prime minister of Israel. So when, as we begin to hear the debate in Israel and the occupied territories today, the accusations of terrorism that fly back and forth do in fact fly back and forth, because I think when it comes to the question of terrorism, there is really a case to be seeing the kind of terrorism that existed on both sides. The day after the British withdrew, the Arabs attacked Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq, and entered parts of Palestine to wage war in Israel. The result of that war was the taking of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now this was still, at this point, this was not part of Israel, we should be clear, the Golan Heights. And so Gaza was taken by the Egyptians, the West Bank was taken by Jordan, and basically kind of claiming, though it never became official, the UN partition. In other words, and again, the partition didn't allow for the self-determination of the Palestinians, but basically what you saw then was an Israel following roughly the lines of the UN partition plan, and the rest of the area held by Jordan on this side and Gaza on the other side. In 1950, the West Bank formally was united with Jordan, became a part of Jordan officially. In 1964, the Cairo conference was called to discuss a decision by the Israelis to take water from the Sea of Tiberias, which was really the source of water for the whole West Bank, to irrigate the Negev desert. And that became, the whole question of water is a very important one for Israel and the occupied territories. And during the Cairo conferences, when the Arab nations recognized the PLO as the liberator of Palestine from Zionism, the other Arab nations recognized the PLO as that in that role. The following period saw massive retaliation for Palestinian resistance. And then came the 67 war. I'm dancing very quickly through this, and I'm sorry about that. But in May of 1967, Nasser of Egypt announced the closing of the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba, down here, to Israeli shipping as a beginning to isolate Israel. On May 30th, Hussein of Jordan signed the military alliance with Egypt. On June 5th, Israel, and so what was clear to the Israelis that there was a preparation to isolate and attack Israel. On June 5th, Israel initiated a preemptive attack against the Egyptian forces in Sinai and also against Jordan, and in the space of one day destroyed Egypt's and Jordan's air force. The Jordanians fought for one more week, really, but it was pretty fruitless. By June 7th, Israel had taken the West Bank, including all of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was divided until that time. Half was in Jordan, half was in the West, in Israel, including the old city. The walled city was part of Jordan. If you've been to Jerusalem, you know there's a kind of a no man's land that goes right along the western side of the old city, and which was the division between East and West Jerusalem. And at that time, they also, Israel took Gaza and the Golan Heights in Syria. And so that territory of Israel, as it considered its territory, was expanded. In February of 1969, Yasser Arafat became the head of the PLO, which united several Palestinian resistance groups. And the PLO, the largest of those groups, was Al-Fatah, which was Arafat's group, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was headed by George Habash. And those still are the two major groups of the PLO today. The PLO operated out of Jordan at that time. That was a problem for Hussein because of the power that the PLO had and the number of Palestinians living in that region. In November of 1974, the UN recognized the PLO as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. In 1978, we had the Camp David Accords, when Sadat and Begin met, and the Sinai, which had been taken during the 67 war also, was given back to Egypt. In 1982, the Israelis invaded Lebanon when the time in which the PLO was then headquartered in Lebanon, and it was an attempt to take out the PLO leadership in order to make things calmer in the occupied territories. And then finally, in 1987, in December of 1987, the uprisings began in the occupied territories, and we'll talk about those a little bit later. We're in the territories, in the West Bank and Gaza. People spontaneously began to revolt against Israeli occupation. And so by 1988, we have Palestinians under occupation for 20 years, displaced for 40 years, a beaten people suffering from a loss of pride. And the uprising, which began in 1987, was unplanned, but it hasn't gone away. It simply hasn't. It's continuing ferment in that region. And what it has done is given the Palestinians a new sense of pride, unity, and, perhaps most important, international recognition of their situation. Now I want to move into the shape of the issues today and to try to understand what are the dynamics today. But before I do that, do you have any questions about this brief history? And I want to emphasize, I'm not an expert on the history of this region, but to try to give you any other points of clarity about who's who here.
Well, what was the nature of the British agreement with the Arabs? Was that I assume there were no written documents?
No, that's correct, as I understand it. There may have been some written agreements in some form, but there's nothing that I know of in terms of its actual. There was a lot of assuming that this would happen if we did this and so forth.
Yeah, I guess that's what Lawrence Moravia's story is. He was the vehicle to transmit oral representations of the government, which in fact weren't correct.
Right.
Another thing you seem to be saying is that there is no formal governmental structure that the Arabs had before Turkey became their occupying.
Right, the Palestinians, we should say here. Okay, because there are other Arab states and various things that emerged in during this time, right? But the Palestinians did not. Now the Palestinians actually have their own governmental structure in the PLO, but we'll talk about that in a moment. Yes?
What does UN Resolution 242 have to say?
I have a copy of it here. Oh. And basically, let me, I can't read the whole thing. But basically, it affirms it calls for the partition of Israel again, and for establishment of a Palestinian state, but it refers to the Palestinians still as a refugee people, which is why the Palestinians wouldn't accept it at the time. Basically now, the Palestinians are willing to accept 242. But maybe we should come back to that after we've looked at some of the issues as they lay out today. The central issue in the conflict, I think it can be said, is the national claim of Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs to the same land. I mean, that's putting it in its simplest form. And there's a tendency to define each people's national existence in a way that denies the other existence. And I think that's not surprising, given the history that I just talked about. The Israelis, centuries of persecution and exclusion, including the Holocaust, and Arab rejection of the State of Israel. Reason to feel paranoid, right? The Palestinians, their self-identity has, from the rest of the Arab world, is more recent than the Jews, but it emerged because of dispossession of property and rights in Palestine, their refugee status throughout the Middle East, and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by Israeli forces. They have come to a new sense of their identity. There are also lots of outside actors in the conflict, of course. The Palestinians' cause is seen as pan-Arab and of interest to all Arabs, at least at the grassroots level. And the PLO has to function as the guest of a host Arab nation. And so there's a strong tie to the Arab world. The Israelis have few Middle East allies, virtually none, but a very powerful ally in the world Jewish community, and of course, a very powerful ally in the US government and the heavy role that we play in the region. There are other actors, of course, the Soviet Union, the Third World, Japan, and so forth, that all have a stake and an interest in what happens here. Now, what's the Israeli position in the current conflict? Actually, it's somewhat diverse. The Israeli position is quite diverse. And it's diverse, part of the reason it's diverse is because Jews came to Israel for a variety of reasons. Some came because of political ideals and commitments to build a state on socialist principles. Some were survivors of the Holocaust and simply had nowhere else to go. Some are religious, but the majority, actually, of Jews living in Israel are not religious Jews. They're trying to forge a national identity out of this kind of diversity, further complicated by the fact of 600,000 Palestinian Arabs in Israel proper. So that not only are we talking about Palestinians in these areas, but that there are 600,000 Palestinians who are citizens of the State of Israel. Now, that becomes an important issue as we move along.
How many Jewish people are
there? It's about 4 million. The population of Israel is about 4 million, not including the occupied territories, 600,000 of which are Palestinian. About 17%, I think, if my figure, it's about, the percentage is about that.
When you say that, that means they're recognized to vote in Israel.
That is correct. The one thing they are excused from service in the Israeli military. But they are allowed to vote, and there are a few members of Palestinian members of the Knesset. Okay. All right.
What's the Knesset?
The Knesset is the Congress, essentially, the legislative body. In now, many questions are faced by Israel at this moment, given that situation. Should they be governed by religious or secular laws? That's the first question. Is it a Jewish state, in the sense it's governed by religious laws, or is it a democracy? And right now, it's a kind of an uneasy combination of the two. Is it important for Israel to be a democracy? And then, if so, how does it preserve its Jewish character? The Palestinian issue, I think, is the single most important issue faced by Israel today. And there are really two major strategies toward the Palestinian issue. One is that's held by the Labor Party. And Peres, of course, who's foreign minister, is head of the Labor Party. The West Bank, in Peres's, in the Labor Party's view, is seen as a bargaining chip to win a peace agreement with Jordan. The idea is to keep some captured territory. If we can achieve a peace agreement with Jordan, we'll keep some of the territory for security purposes, but return the most heavily populated Palestinian areas to Jordan and to Jordanian sovereignty, not Palestinian sovereignty. Return them to Jordan, if Jordan will make peace with Israel. That's basically the Labor position. And that's, in some respects, the essence of the Schultz plan, the recent Schultz plan. The Likud, or the more party more to the right of Labor, the party of Begin and Shamir, suggests that Israel's control of the West Bank is non-negotiable. They have developed a plan for limited Palestinian autonomy under Israeli sovereignty, but control of the West Bank is not up for discussion. One of the key elements in their approach are the West Bank settlements. You've heard of the West Bank settlements? West Bank settlements are, in many cases, some small but some huge housing developments scattered throughout the West Bank for Israeli settlers. And there are some, it's estimated 60 to 70,000 Israeli settlers now in these settlements on the West Bank. And it's part of the Likud strategy to say, we're not giving up this territory. We're putting our people there. And what's ironic is this really fuels the crisis, because often the people who go into those settlements are the most reactionary Jews. They're the pioneers, right? They're going out to tame the Wild West, with many of the same kinds of attitudes towards the Palestinians as our early settlers had towards our indigenous population. And so you have some tremendous conflicts, because these settlements will grow up right beside an Arab village, take their water, do all sorts of things, and the conflicts that emerge are really quite severe. The invasion of Lebanon, as I said, in 1982, was a Likud strategy to destroy the Palestinian infrastructure, making Israeli control of the West Bank and Gaza an easier task. Now, in recent years, many Israelis have been diverging from these two main lines in both directions. On the left, many believe Israel's refusal to deal directly with the Palestinians a fatal flaw, and that most Palestinians do not want to live under Jordanian rule. It's simply not feasible, that some kind of Palestinian state is necessary and inevitable. There are many, not a majority by any means, but a substantial number of Israelis who are beginning to think that way. On the right, however, there are many who are questioning the strategy of limited autonomy, which indeed they should, because the Palestinians will never accept that either, but have taken a stronger stand against any sort of compromise. The most extreme is a group headed by Meir Kahan, some of you have heard of him, who advocates the removal of all Palestinians from Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. Expulsion, period. Get them out.
To where?
That's not important. The rest of the Arab world, where they belong. Mm-hmm. Back to Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same idea. One of the looming actions here that we should talk about is the potential annexation of the West Bank and Gaza. Now, what's important to recognize here is that at the time of the 67 war, Israel did annex East Jerusalem. In other words, it made it part of Israel. An act that has not been recognized by most of the world community today. Most do not recognize the Israeli annexation of East Jerusalem. Most of the world still says that it's part of Jordan. as it does with the West Bank. The Israelis did not annex the West Bank or Gaza. Okay? They are considered occupied territories by the Israelis and by the rest of the world. They're the territory of some other country occupied by Israel. In this case, it's territory of Jordan. It's less clear about what Gaza Strip is the territory of today. So the question is asked, why not annex the West Bank? It presents a real crisis for democracy if this is done in Israel. It's the issue, and the issue is the higher birth rate of Arabs than Israelis. If they were to annex, and that is if we consider this whole area, including the West Bank and the Strip, Arabs will outnumber Israelis by the early part of the next century. Outnumber Jews, that is. And so if annexed, and Arabs are given their full rights as citizens, the Arabs would soon be the majority, and it would no longer be a Jewish state. If it's annexed, and they're not given their rights, it would no longer be a democracy. And in fact, it would become even more repressive than it already is for the Arabs. So you see the dilemma that the Israelis are facing. Now, because of the loss of votes of the two major parties, Labor and Likud, in the last election, neither had enough to vote to control the government, and so a coalition was formed. And over the last 4 years, it's been a very strange coalition, really, in which Likud had the Shamir of the Likud was foreign minister, and Peres of the Labor Party was prime minister during the first 2 years, and the second 2 years they switched positions, right? But it in many respects has immobilized the Israeli government in many of its decisions. A new election, the next elections are held almost at the same time of our elections this November. And it's really nobody's sure what's going to happen. Now, that's the Israelis. The Palestinians are also divided, 600,000 in Israel, 1.3 million in West Bank and Gaza, 1 million in Jordan, and small numbers in Arab countries in Europe. And while they're divided geographically, and the variety of circumstances in which they live, of course, cause them to have differences in their political perspective, there is considerable agreement on the main priorities for Palestinians. Number one, the right to self-determination. Number two, the desire for a sovereign state within historic Palestine. Those two are almost universally held principles. The PLO is an umbrella organization of several Palestinian liberation groups, and it is a kind of government with leadership elected by a national council, which represents a cross-section of the Palestinian community from all over the world. It really is a kind of government. Now, initially, the PLO goal was to liberate all of Palestine and create a democratic, secular state in the place of Israel. Since the mid-1970s, however, the PLO has been pursuing a political solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, emphasizing the establishment of a Palestinian state on a part, but not necessarily all, of Palestine. A move that Palestinians say implicitly recognizes the right of Israel to exist. Now we're moving up to the sticky point between the two. You see it coming. Most PLO, this is an interesting point, I think, most PLO's principal member organizations specifically prohibit terrorism against civilians in their mode of activity. Now, the vast majority of Palestinians recognize the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of Palestinians, and they endorse PLO entry into any negotiations that offer a reasonable prospect of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Now, most likely this would be a state confederated in some way with Jordan, but there are many Palestinians, interestingly enough, who suggest a confederation with Israel, because after all, we know how to deal with them, right? We know we have some, even if it's been a hate relationship, we can figure out a way. The sticking point is that most Palestinians are not prepared to recognize the legitimacy of the state of Israel as a precondition for sitting down at the negotiating table without similar recognition by Israel of Palestine. A Palestinian's right to self-determination. Now, did you follow that? Palestinians are not willing to recognize that the state of Israel, unless Israel is willing to recognize that the Palestinians have a right to self-determination. It's a catch-22 in many ways because, you know, the Palestinians are saying, well, look, you want us to recognize you, but we're nothing. So how can nothing recognize you? Right? We'll come back to that in a minute. Now, what do they fear from each other? What the Palestinians fear is a continuation of repression and discrimination that currently exists in both Israel and the occupied territories. And you don't have to visit there very long to understand that level of discrimination. And we've begun to see it, I think, in the televised coverage of the uprisings. And the continuing disenfranchisement, that's what they fear. What Israelis fear is they do not trust the Palestinians once independent to allow Israel to exist. They're surrounded by Arab countries. Israelis are often say, well, the Arabs can lose many wars, we can only lose one. And so they're afraid of that. Israelis fear destruction by the Arab world around them. And they have not heard, they say, an official statement from the PLO that they will recognize Israel's right to exist. And again, Palestinians believe the first step must be the Israelis. Because how can the PLO recognize Israel if Israel does not recognize them as an entity? Palestinians, in fact, believe that recognition must be concurrent. That it has to happen. You know, the discussions happen and we say, now at this time, we're going to recognize each other. Not one before the other. Now, most Palestinians and some peace-oriented Israelis are calling for a two-state solution to the crisis. And my own opinion is that some kind of two-state solution is the only solution that can make sense for this region. It would be roughly concurrent with the boundaries of the occupied territories as they now exist, probably with some sort of corridor between the two. Each country could have its own right of return, as Israel has, for anyone who was born in Israel or who is Jewish can return and settle in Israel. The West Bank and the Gaza Strip could have that own right of return for Palestinians, though many would not return, most would not. It might well, probably would be a demilitarized country, the Palestinian country. It would be demilitarized and not have an army. Most Palestinians accept that and are willing to accept that. One of the problems is, what about Jerusalem? Because neither side is willing to give up Jerusalem as their capital. And so there have been some proposals for Jerusalem as an international city that is really the capital of two countries. In one sense, it seems almost so impossible for anything like to happen, given the animosity that exists between these two peoples. On the other hand, the idea of Jerusalem being truly an international city is a visionary kind of idea. I mean, it seems so far from reality, and yet it's an idea that is really kind of a marvelous one. Finally, one of the biggest roadblocks to U.S. policy to a settlement is U.S. policy, I think. What is the U.S. position in this region? And it was very interesting. A U.S. diplomat in Syria described to a group that I was with at the embassy in Syria one time, he said, someone asked him, well, what is our policy in the region? And his response was, very sarcastically, what's good for Israel is good for the U.S. And I think very critical of the policy, as you interestingly find many State Department officials privately in the Middle East are critical of our policy. It's seen as solidly behind the mainline Israeli position. The U.S. ambassador in Jordan, who we met with when I was there in April, is a good example of how our policy plays itself out. First of all, he said Palestinian self-determination is simply not an option. He says it's often not an option for people. For example, my grandfather in Tennessee wanted self-determination about 100 years ago, and it was not an option for him to have self-determination. In this case, it's not an option for the Palestinians to have self-determination. So his parallel was the Civil War. It seems to me is something lacking in his depth of analysis about who the people who live in this territory. Another argument that's claimed by the U.S. is that this is a non-viable state, that there's not enough here to sustain a state. It seems to me that as outsiders, we're not the ones to determine the viability of a state. There are many states who have far less resources than the occupied territories would have in order to make them, allow them to survive. Many Palestinians say what they'd like to create in the occupied territories is a Silicon Valley, which we may question that, but nevertheless, there are kind of plans for that sort of development. Current U.S. aid to Israel is about $3 billion a year, the single highest recipient of U.S. aid in the world. And about half of that, I believe, I've forgotten the figures, is military aid. In exchange for that support, what does Israel do for us? It does many things, and in many respects, it serves as a surrogate for our policies in the rest of the world. We'll talk about this perhaps on Thursday night, but for example, when the United States finally did not support Somoza anymore in the last months of his reign in Nicaragua, the one country that supported Somoza to the end was Israel. During the time in earlier in the 80s, when we were not providing any kind of aid to Guatemala because of the severe human rights violations in Guatemala, where was that aid coming from? From Israel. Israel is a very important actor in Central America, as a matter of fact. There are a number of problems, I think, with our policy, and I'll just allude to a couple of them and then let you ask some questions. There's a tendency to overestimate the power of the underestimate the power of the aspirations and struggles of ordinary people. And I think we're seeing this in the uprising today in the occupied territories, that the refusal to recognize the Palestinian people, both on the part of the United States and the of Israel, is sheer blindness, in my opinion. And there's also, I think, a tendency to retire entirely too much on military solutions to solve political conflicts. And I think nowhere is there a better example of that than in the current situation in the Middle East. We could talk more about that, but I think we need to take some time for you to respond. And I'm sorry there was so much info. But
a number of years ago, I read The Hodge by Leon Uris. It was the first experience I had of any kind of cultural understanding of the Arabs. Mm-hmm. How accurate do you think that is?
I find The Hodge a very, frankly, a racist book. I mean, I think it has some good historical facts, but I think it really portrays the Arab population in a way that reinforces stereotypes rather than creating a new image of who the Arab people are. It was interesting, I read that book on my first trip to the Middle East, and so I kept seeing it in juxtaposition with what I saw as the... I think some of the historical stuff is helpful in it. But I think it portrays the Arab, it reinforces the stereotypes.
Yeah, I found myself saying, how could Arabs ever rule themselves if there was no kind of...
Right. Yeah, ask a Palestinian in this country about that book, and you'll, the fire will... Yes.
Yeah, I heard an interesting theory, I think I even read in The Atlantic, where there is a belief among Arabs that the... creation of Israel was more or less an extension of a crusade where the Christians were tired of going in and getting beat up, so we found the Jews and used them as our surrogate colonists so we could get control of the Holy Land. And there's a lot of Palestinians or Arabs who have this belief, which throws the guilt back on us, so we're the ultimate perpetrator.
I haven't heard that theory, but it is, we are, in many eyes of Arab peoples, the very strongly implicated in the problem. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Could you just tell us what Jordan's view of the Palestinians are? I mean, that's not a friendly...
Well, no, it isn't. See, that's very complicated, too, because Jordan doesn't know quite what to do. You know, Hussein doesn't want all those Palestinians in Jordan because that would threaten him, right? Hussein is not a Palestinian. He's a Bedouin. Mm-hmm. And so there's that kind of... That sort of love-hate sort of relationship. Every Jordanian will say they're for Palestinian self-determination. But partly is, officially, this is part of Jordan, and officially Hussein is supposed to want that back, right? But, again, it puts him in a very unusual situation because he'd have a majority of people being Palestinians. And so some suggest that in that case, Hussein could be finished. Hussein has to walk a very delicate balance. And but yet at the same time, a million Palestinians live in Jordan. Many of the people in the Jordanian government are Palestinians. We met with the minister of the occupied territories, who's Palestinian, of course. Yeah.
I've never really understood the Israeli argument that they have to hold these territories for defensive reasons. This seems to be, perhaps could have been more true 20, 30 years ago, but with modern technology, the weapons involved, it seems that that argument is largely obsolete.
Well, I think many are making that very argument today, and I think there's another argument that's being made that's related to that is the notion that if the question is Israel's national security, that, and it's an argument I make about our own foreign policy as well, and you'll be hearing me make it all week, that is, you're in better shape with your national security if you have friends around you than if you have enemies. You know, it's as simple as that. And that creating, the policy is creating hostility, fermenting hostility, not lessening the hostility. And so some kind of policy has to be put in place that really lessens the threat, not heightens it.
But I gather that's the official Israeli view, at least one of their justifications for holding these territories, that it would compromise national security.
Exactly.
But the argument is essentially specious as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Well, yeah. There's some truth on the Golan Heights, so holding that?
Because of Syria. Because of
Syria.
Yeah, it's possible, but again, in terms of, you know, it's a half hour, 15-minute plane flight. I mean, these things are so close that, yeah. I mean, it land forces don't really mean that much
that's
anymore.
Why, that's the point, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you figure the distances here, it's just unbelievable. I mean,
comment on the military superiority issue. As you mentioned, Israel eliminated the air forces of two other countries in one day. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it still retain pretty much that same military advantage as the Arab states next to it?
I think it is. I think it does, basically. At least that's, I don't know the military figures very well, but in my understanding, it does maintain that kind of superiority. And again, one of the factors you have to recognize in this policy, one of the reasons we support this, is that we have a whole arms market and industry that feeds on this. You know, we're supplying arms to both sides here. A real resolution of this conflict, what does that mean for our market? We're seeing all of the revelation of the Pentagon scandals now and all this sort of thing. You know, how much of a factor is that in the continuation of this kind of crisis? Because of, I mean, we're talking about $1.5 billion. And the second highest recipient of our aid is Egypt. Third is El Salvador, by the way. we have reached 5 o'clock, and I'm very willing to stay and answer questions and talk some more about this. I'm sorry, but I'll try and allow more time in future sessions. But I'm glad to stay. I do want to end the session now. And thank you for your participation. I hope it's helped at least sort through some of the issues. And that's sort of what we'll be trying to do each time, to sort through what are the major issues, and then pull some themes out later. So thank you very much.